From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Duluth, Minnesota, in early 2016. Now, maybe you've heard of NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts. Musicians will come in to perform in the cramped space behind Bob Boylan's desk. He's the host of All Songs Considered. And NPR has created a Tiny Desk contest, drawing thousands of submissions from aspiring musicians and bands across the country. In fact, more than 6,100 submissions came in for NPR's 2016 version of the Tiny Desk contest. The winner was a woman from Duluth, Minnesota, named Galen Lee. She's a violin player, but not in the style you might expect. Galen was born with a condition known as brittle bone disease. In adulthood, she weighs only 68 pounds, and growing up, it was almost impossible for her to physically handle musical instruments like a guitar or a trombone. But Galen fell in love first with the cello, and thanks to some experimentation, she learned to play the violin in the same way that someone would play a cello, sitting behind it with the same kind of physical interpretation. Galen has become an outstanding violin player, and she works both in solo fashion and with other musicians. She teaches, but she did not expect to win NPR's national contest. She did. This coming Saturday, Galen Lee is coming to Nazareth College. She's going to perform at the Schultz Center at 1:30 on Saturday afternoon. The ticket price is just $5. And in her own right, she's a talented musician, but she's also a proud advocate for people with disabilities everywhere. In a moment, we'll welcome Galen to Connections. She'll discuss everything from her musical career to her journey in making all stages accessible. But before we do that, we thought we should listen to the song that won NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. Here's Galen Lee's song, Someday We'll Linger in the Sun.
Time, the subtle feet fall. It slips away when we play no mind. We pull the weeds out till the dawn, nearly too tired to carry on. Someday we'll linger in the sun, and I love you. And I love you.
Your music is remarkable, and we're going to talk about advocating for musicians with disabilities, access, inclusion, what that all means. But what I don't want to do is pigeonhole you as a musician with a disability, because your music is your music, and it is fabulous on its own right. Do you have any concerns about, you know, sort of being discussed as the musician with the disability as opposed to just a fabulous musician?
Yeah, it's an interesting one that I'm still kind of figuring out, because obviously I hope and I think most of the time when people go to shows, like when they enjoy it, that's, you know, it's because of the music and that's what I want, obviously. And so, yeah, I don't always necessarily want to be referred to as the musician with a disability. But then the other part of it is too, you know, so when I play shows, I guess is what I'm saying, you know, I want that to be about the music. But I do this whole other realm of public speaking about disability rights. And so obviously it is a big part of my identity. But I don't think it informs my music, like in the way that would be the only thing somebody would walk away like thinking about.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So let's talk about the music first, and then we're going to talk about advocacy and inclusion and access. So let's talk about the music. For listeners who are going to be new to your work, your style, your approach, how do you describe it?
Well, I don't know yet. I guess the way I describe it mostly is, you know, I use a looping pedal to create a lot of layers with my violin. And then some of the music I play is experimental takes on traditional fiddle tunes. And then the rest of it is my original music, which is songs that I've written. And they're, you know, I don't know how you call it, probably indie folk, I guess. But it's a little different because it's all, especially when I'm playing solo, it's all based around the strings. So it's, you know, it's sort of orchestral sounding, I guess, even though it's regular, you know, indie songs.
There were more than 6,100 submissions for NPR's Tiny Desk Contest in 2016, and your song Someday Will Linger in the Sun stood out to NPR. Just an amazing thing. Can you take me through the process of finding out and what that meant to you to stand out in that kind of a national contest?
Yeah. It was, I entered the contest. I entered that contest because a couple friends and fiddle students were telling me about it. I had heard of the radio series, but I hadn't actually heard of that contest. And so I decided to enter, and I really, truly did not think that I was going to win, not even for a second, but I submitted the video and just kind of didn't hear anything for about a month. And then one day I was teaching lessons, and I got an email in between my lessons for my fiddle students. And the email just said, this is NPR, and we'd like to talk to you today, if possible. And I just remember feeling super nervous and thinking that maybe I was a finalist, because I think how they actually judge the contest is they divide up the submissions into groups, and people kind of give a cursory listen, and then they set aside the ones they really like, you know what I mean? And then all the judges listen to the final group. I think that's how it actually works, because I had read about it somewhere. So I thought maybe I was a finalist. We set up this phone call later that afternoon, and I get the phone call, and it's Bob Boylan on the other end of the line, the host of the show. And he started talking to me about not just the song I entered, but all the other music that I had put out already. And it was just a really surreal phone call, and he didn't tell me right away that I won, but about 5 minutes in, he's like, and the reason I'm calling is because I want to let you know that we want to choose you as the winner, which was just very surreal. I don't know. I'll never forget that moment. You know what I mean? I didn't know how life would change, but I knew that it was definitely going to be a big thing, for me. And then it turned out changing a lot of things.
Did they tell you have to lock this up for a little while? You can't tell anyone yet?
Yeah, that was the hardest part, is they said they weren't going to announce it for about a week. And so I was allowed to tell my husband, obviously, and my immediate family. And then I could tell the person who filmed it, and I could tell my bandmate, Alan, because he was going to come out and do a couple of songs with me. And so some people knew, but then the rest of the world didn't. I had a show that night, actually, the night I found out that I won. And I wasn't allowed to talk about it, which was so weird. I don't know. I just remember being like, the whole week was like the longest, basically.
So what's going on in your life? Nothing much.
No, I'm not joking. Like, at the show, this guy came up and he's like, Galen, how is music going? That's exactly how he asked it. And I remember being like, oh my gosh, I can't tell him. This is so weird. But it was only a week. And it was kind of a fun, for my family to know and my husband to know. It was kind of a fun, suspenseful week that we got to relish in, I guess, for like a few days.
Well, listeners, go seek out Someday We'll Linger in the Sun. Easy to find, and you'll see why it won NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. Now, this is where I give NPR some credit, because Someday We'll Linger in the Sun doesn't show up on modern pop radio, which plays roughly 12 Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift songs total. And and no offense to the Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift fans in the audience, but there's not a whole lot of variety. So I'm curious to know what you listen to, what you like to listen to these days, and what your thoughts are of modern pop radio and what that does to sort of our sensibilities in terms of consuming. Does that watering down and narrowing of options for the consuming public, does that injure our musical taste? I'm curious to know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that there is some consequence to that for sure. What I personally listen to, I listened to a lot of Simon and Garfunkel growing up, and big band music. Those were I don't know why, but those were the things I listened to a lot. And then in college, I got into music with real lyrics that I appreciate. I'm a really big lyrics person. And so I like the Decemberists a lot, and Neutral Milk Hotel, and Wilco, and just different bands that I liked. I resonated with the lyrics and obviously the melodies too. And I guess then when I moved back to my hometown of Duluth, Duluth, Minnesota has a really vibrant, Duluth, Minnesota has a really vibrant music scene. And so there's just a ton to listen to, and they're all great. Like, there's so much good music in my town. Charlie Parr and Lowe, and there's a lady named Mary Bew that I love. And I don't know, there's just so many. I could list like a million of them because it's a little town up north that just, for some reason, there's just a ton going on. And so that's kind of what I got into after college. But in terms of the radio question, I guess I feel like what people don't think about when they only hear a certain selection, it's not like that music is necessarily bad. You know, I don't want to judge music, but I do think it kind of limits what you think is out there. You know, we're on the road now a lot, and so people will share the stage with us about like a band that we'll open for, they'll open for us, and it just, it blows my mind how good everyone is. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much good music out there, and I feel like we sometimes get stuck thinking that we've heard it all or that we kind of know what music is. And then all of a sudden you discover, like, there's just a huge wide variety and we're only picking a few. It's like the grocery store, only picking, like, the best-looking fruits are the only main things that you ever eat, and then you realize there's just like a ton more out there. And I think you just kind of miss that this creativity or like an appreciation of something that is super unique. That happens a lot. I wish there was, I mean, public radio is so important for that reason. You know what I mean? To keep that stuff, and college radio, to keep that stuff out there. I don't know why commercial radio hasn't figured out. I feel like you could have a lot more variety and still be a viable station, you know what I mean? Just because there's so much good music in the world, but somehow that hasn't come across in any kind of commercial radio.
Well, PBS asked you a question that confused me a little. Help me out here. They wanted to know, were there other instruments you tried before violin and fiddle? I thought the fiddle is a violin played in more of a, you know, sort of a John Denver-y style or John Summers. Is that not correct?
No, you're correct. You know, fiddle music is more of a style for sure. I think, you know, the people think of them a little differently, like classical violin is what I did for the first 8 years. And so I realized I played in orchestra and the music we played was like Tchaikovsky and Mozart and that kind of stuff. But fiddle music, it's obvious, it's definitely the same instrument, but it's just a totally different heritage. It's not even so much John, like, Denver as, like, the music that people used to play when they had dances. That's what they did for fun, you know, is get together and have dances, and you needed music to dance to. And that's what most fiddle music comes from, is dances.
And listeners, so, when you watch Galen play, there is, because of Galen's condition, she and maybe a teacher came up with a very interesting way to approach the violin. So let's go back to your childhood. You mentioned that in fourth grade, the orchestra went to your school and you loved it, but you had to figure out sort of what would work. So, you know, you, like a lot of people, love that cello, I know, but take me through the process of trying to figure out, can I play the cello, and how you ended up with the violin?
So I just remember thinking, well, I want to do the cello. And I went home that day in fourth grade and told my mom, you know, next year I'm going to join orchestra and I'm going to play the cello. And luckily, my parents have always been very encouraging. And you know, the reality of disability is that you always have to adapt to stuff every single day. So adaptation isn't like some big dramatic thing usually. You know, like for me, it was just kind of a way of thinking about anything I wanted to do. Usually was modified to some extent. So I just said, I'm going to play the cello. And she said, okay, I'm sure you'll figure it out. But the lucky part was in fifth grade that I had a teacher who is open-minded enough to actually do that with me, to modify. I realized as an adult, actually it was because of the tiny desk, how, you know, very easily she could have just said, I don't know how you're going to play. You should probably just do choir, you know, like, I don't think this is going to be possible, but she wasn't like that at all. And so together we just kind of tried different instruments. And the cello was definitely too big, even the little ones. And the violin couldn't get up on my, shoulder, but it did end up working to play it like a tiny cello. And I hold my bow like a bass player does. And I've been playing that way ever since. And every teacher I've had since her, all the way through high school, was willing to just kind of help me play, you know, as best I could. And it was violin music always, and generally we thought of it as a violin, but the technique is a lot actually closer to a cello.
What an amazing story. Yeah. And in a moment we're going to revisit the importance of having teachers who are open-minded to creative ideas to bring opportunity to people with disabilities, because look at what has happened here. This is an amazing story, but make sure our audience understands here the reason you can't handle physically a cello is, I think I read, you only weigh 68 pounds now, is that right? And the condition,
yep.
So you know, you're small, cellos are large, and your disability is called osteogenesis imperfecta. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, it's known as brittle bones disease, and so it's a collagen disorder, it's a genetic disorder, and so the collagen in my bones just isn't the same consistency. Well, in my whole body, as anyone else's. And so my bones are a lot lighter and more fragile than most people's bones. And so before I was born, I broke a lot of bones in utero. They don't really know how many, because it was before ultrasounds were good enough to really see what was going on. But my arms and legs are bent in like 90-degree angles, kind of. They don't hurt anymore, obviously, because they were already healed by the time I was born. But that's why the cello wouldn't work, is because my arms are really short. But not only that, they're kind of at these specific angles that just didn't work with the way you hold a bow usually. So I really needed a smaller instrument that the angles worked and the lengths worked and all that stuff.
I think when people hear the term brittle bones disease, they assume that, you know, you're going to suffer a number of broken bones and other related issues. Is that true?
Yeah, I broke about 16 bones growing up at different times. Usually, in my case, it was because I would fall out of my wheelchair or something bad like that would happen. But brittle bones disease, because it's a genetic collagen defect, like the way that it presents itself is very, very different from person to person. So some people break a lot more bones than I do, and a lot more frequently. I haven't broken one in probably 4 years now. I'm sure I will again, though. You know, it just kind of depends on what is happening. But some people have much brittler bones than I do, and they break them, you know, when they sneeze or if they fall at all. And I've been pretty lucky that way. But I mean, you know, it changes too. I think kids generally break more than adults until, you know, your hormones change, and then sometimes it slows down. So I don't know. Yes, it's very varied. There's actually like 8 or 9 types of OI, brittle bones disease, but they're just discovering more and more variations. So it's kind of an interesting disability.
My guest is the creator of the winning song from NPR's 2016 Tiny Desk Contest. The song is Someday We'll Linger in the Sun. And Galen happens to also be talking about her work despite or alongside her brittle bones disease, known as osteogenesis imperfecta. She is a world-class talent that had teachers who were willing to say, okay, yeah, maybe not the cello, but maybe we play the violin like the cello. Maybe we find a different way to do this. And what an amazing result. So I want to ask you kind of a two-part question. In your work as an advocate, do you look back at those teachers and do you see an opening for other people with various disabilities? It doesn't have to be the exact condition you have. And do you think, you know, it so often requires a teacher or a mentor or a supporter who sees a different way of trying something but doesn't close the door entirely? And then having looked at it that way, I'd like to hear from you what you think we all could do to become better advocates.
Yeah, I definitely think teachers have an important role to play in this kind of, you know, helping people with disabilities get more involved in the arts in general. You know, I think it kind of informed my teaching later, because I ended up teaching fiddle for 3 or 4 years before I won the contest. And I guess it kind of just, like, it's not the teacher's job to tell someone that they can't do something, you know? Even if the student doesn't have, like, an amazing aptitude, where it's very obvious that they're going to, like, you know, put a ton of energy into something. It's just that the teacher's job is to facilitate trying something new and expression, like allowing kids to express themselves through art. And so, however, you know, the kid can be involved, it's really important to be open to the idea that it's worth trying and it's not your job to put any roadblocks up. And so I think about this a lot because I wasn't the best violinist in my orchestra. You know, we had some kids that started when they were 3 and, you know, and they practiced forever. And I wasn't in the very top of my orchestra. And that's really not what it's about, because when you end up being, especially as an adult, somebody who creates their own art, it doesn't need to be like perfect form. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and so the one thing I think for teachers to remember when they're working with students with disabilities, but really any student, I think it doesn't have to just be someone with a disability. I think the whole point is to realize that you're not necessarily grooming people to be the next, like, Yo-Yo Ma. You're just grooming them to make music and express themselves, and then they will figure out what works for them. And so I have I always think that if you found a student that even if they played, it didn't sound, you know, the same. Like, mine is pretty comparable, the way I play. I ended up being able to do pretty much all the music my orchestra could do. But even if I had some limitations, be like more than that, where I couldn't have played, you know, super fast or super loud or whatever it was, I still think it's important to play, because you can still create your own, you know, think about what abstract art is, right? Like, it doesn't mean that you have to be a very particular type of artist. You just have to be able to express yourself. And that's the teacher's job, is to facilitate that up as much as possible. I guess if that makes any sense. Like, it's important to me the teachers don't put up roadblocks, for sure.
Absolutely. And then for the rest of us, I'm thinking of just your live performances and you know, your own considerations for getting around, moving equipment, accessing different stages, something that some people may take for granted. Take me through what that process is like for you and how you view inclusion and access in that realm.
Yeah, I mean, so that's where the real barriers start. So even if you have an encouraging teacher and you do learn how to play, once you get out there, you realize that it's not super accessible. I mean, I would say at this point, probably only about 30% of the stages we play are accessible, and we have to get my chair lifted up a lot. You know, I'm talking about it a lot, so I'm hoping that starts changing. But it's, you know, the reason it's a big deal is not just because of me, right? Although it is really frustrating to have to get out of my chair and have 4 people lifted up, and like, it's not good for the wheelchair, and it doesn't have the same quality vibe to me as somebody else just walking on stage. But beyond that, even what if I was a little kid with a disability going to a concert and I see that happening? I mean, that's a discouraging thing. You know what I mean? It's like having to walk, you know, watch your peers like have to use the back door instead of the front door. You know what I mean? And I think it's important. Like, it doesn't send a good message to the youth with disabilities if the music industry isn't accessible. You know what I mean? And so the more we can do now, the more that you can inspire the next generation of little kids with disabilities, or just in general, you know, to know that music is going to be something that could be accessible to them too. Because you shouldn't have to, you know, I'm a pretty outgoing person, and so I advocate for myself, you know, when I need to, and I really try to be open and honest about what could be improved, but not everybody is outgoing, and I don't know if you should always have to expect people with disabilities to constantly have to work super duper hard to do what other people do without thinking about it, you know, and that, and what I mean by that is accessibility. I mean, I think accessibility is very, very far behind, unfortunately, and it's hopefully going to keep getting better. But yeah, and that's where everyone can be an ally, is when you notice something isn't accessible, or you realize some policy being proposed is going to hurt people with disabilities. It's not just an us against them sort of thing. It's a place where you could step in and advocate too, so that their voices are louder and things happen faster, hopefully.
I hope so. Well, let me close with this question then. Since winning Tiny Desk, did that add any pressure that you feel about your own creation of music, your own performance? Obviously, winning Tiny Desk is a wonderful thing. It's an amazing accomplishment, and you know, it's given you this platform, but I wonder if you feel any added pressure because of it.
Well, I've never been asked that question before. You know, performance-wise, you know, I had been performing for about 10 years before I won, and it was all locally, but I performed pretty often, like 8 times a month, I would say. And so I took it seriously, but it does kind of change when you realize, like, people are driving to come see you, or you're doing this as a job now rather than just a thing that you do for fun in addition to teaching. It changed it, but it didn't change it in a way. I guess I've always felt like the audience is worth you giving your best. You know what I mean? Like, they're there to hear you, and it's not respectful to blow it off. So I've always tried to do my best in performances. The one thing that has changed a little bit is, yeah, that idea when you start doing music and touring for a living, you know, you realize that there is like a cycle out there where people record an album and then they tour with it, and then they go home and they work on some new stuff and they record another album. And like, I kind of started songwriting later. I was 27 before I ever wrote a song, and I just want to try to remain, you know, authentic and not like create music because I feel like I'm on some sort of schedule. You know what I mean? And so I think like one big thing I've been thinking about a lot lately, because I am making a new album, because I did actually write a bunch of new songs and there's some old ones that have never been recorded. And so I'm making a full band album right now. But after this album is done, I want to make sure that anything that I create is because I actually have a creative spark and not just because I feel like I'm on some kind of deadline. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely.
So that's maybe the only difference that I've noticed that could have some sort of impact. It's going to be mindful about, are you creating because you want to create or because you feel this pressure to create? And I don't want to do it for that reason. And I think it'll be okay, but it's good to be aware of it. You know what I mean?
Well, thank you for sharing your musical gifts with the world and for your time with us and the work you're doing in advocacy. But also, again, I'll return to where we started this interview. The music itself stands and speaks for itself. It is wonderful and very deserving of the honors you've gotten. Thank you for the time, and I know we'll talk again. Best of luck in the future, Galen.
Thank you so very much.
I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, President Trump says that Americans should consider Obamacare dead and buried. But it's not. So what are our options with open enrollment coming? We'll discuss the choices Americans have and the state of healthcare legislation. Then in our second hour, the Rochester Gay Men's Chorus is celebrating 35 years. We'll listen to some music. We'll talk to some members about how the chorus has promoted social change through its performances. That's Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Wayne in Rochester called the program just to send this note. He said, "It's hard to drive with tears in your eyes. I had to pull over to cry. This show is beautiful." Well, if you enjoyed the conversation with Galen Lee and her music, you can hear her at 1:30 on Saturday afternoon at the Schultz Center at Nazareth College. $5 for admission. That's all. And a great opportunity. I want to bring in a couple of Galen Lee fans, by the way. I'm in studio now with Erica Jones, who's a systems advocate for the Center for Disability Rights. Erica, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Betsy King is a professor of music therapy at Nazareth College. Betsy, welcome back to you as well.
Glad to be here.
All right. So Saturday, 1:30, Galen Lee, and the music is outstanding. I thought, and Betsy, I kind of want to start with you here because I was so moved. I had heard her music before I saw her perform. I was so moved watching her play the violin like we assume most people play a cello. Such a creative approach. And she talked in that conversation about the importance of having teachers to say yes and.
Yes.
Yes, we're going to do this, and how are we going to do this, and what are we going to do? And I thought that was beautiful. What did you make of that?
Well, Erica and I had been chatting about this. Both of us have played the violin. I was a violin performance major in college, and she got a lot more discouragement than I did about it, and it's just so unfortunate. And one of the things we talked about was that my first exposure to any person with a disability, because I started playing the violin when I was six, my first exposure was seeing Itzhak Perlman. And so my first exposure to a person who used a wheelchair or had physical impairments was somebody who was famous and also who was playing the instrument that I was playing. So there could not have been a more open, accepting introduction for me to everybody should be able to have a try. And Erica got sort of the opposite experience. So I do think having people around you that I really, what really spoke to me in the interview was the very end when Galen said the effect that her appearances have on her younger audience members and that she wants the stage to be accessible so that they can see her as being somebody who's just another performer who plays differently, but plays beautifully. And that's why that access is so important. So yeah, I think it's teachers. I think it's accessibility in the environment and also just attitude, what you get exposed to.
Erica, what was your experience?
Well, I was in elementary school when I first got interested in the violin. And honestly, I didn't have many options for instruments that I could physically play. I desperately wanted to be a drummer. I wanted to be in a rock band. But there wasn't a force speaking in my ear as to how I could do that. How, because I didn't have as much use of my legs. How could I hit the foot pedals? How could I do this? How could I do that? So because we couldn't imagine how to do this, I was discouraged. And my options were either violin or I could go into flute like my cousin did.
And so what did you do?
I ended up going into violin for a while.
But it wasn't her chosen instrument,
yeah,
which is what's
right,
such a shame.
Right. It seemed like a kind of a fallback when you really wanted to drum.
Right.
And I guess I have to say, Eric, I'm a little surprised at the, okay, so maybe you can't do a foot pedal, but I would think that drums are certainly within reach for someone like yourself. Okay, you're in a wheelchair, but I don't fully get why they were closing doors, whereas someone like Galen, they were looking for ways to open doors.
I really think it depends on the environment that you grew up in. Like now, people can look to individuals like Jason Gerling, who is a wheelchair user, who is a drummer, was a drummer before his accident, and invented a way for him to continue to do that. But that was on him to determine how he was going to continue. And so now, because he's done this and because he has publicly stated, if you want to know how I did this, I'll show you for free. I'll send you the specs. Kids can have that option. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, I didn't have that option.
And I think one of the things that Galen said that was so important was that that for her teachers, they didn't think, well, I'm not willing to teach you unless you can become excellent, famous in the traditional way. When the child just wants access to the experience. And I was sharing with Erica earlier that I talked to a parent recently whose son, who's on the spectrum, wanted to be in band and was able to do all he needed to do in the percussion section, but he needed to come to the band room 20 minutes early and sit there and let everybody else enter so he could get used to the sound building up. And the school didn't allow him to do it. And that cut off his access to the band experience at school. And you just think, why? What is the power struggle to just opening doors? You know, I think people are anxious about control, and I think people are anxious about the unknown. But isn't it more fun to play with it and to get creative?
Absolutely. I think, the lesson from Galen Lee, I think Betsy makes an important point here. It's not just that you want to open the door for the next Perlman. or the next Galen Lee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just for everyone to have the chance to access an experience. And you heard Galen say that as a teacher, she thinks it's important to say, I am not going to be the one to tell you, you can't. We may have to get creative, but I'm not going to be that person. And so, Erica, tell me, even outside of music, mm-hmm. for people with various disabilities, how important is it for them, especially when they're young, to hear that yes and sort of approach from people around them?
Oh, my God, it's so important. This is why people give up, because they've had somebody in their past that discourage them and make them feel like they can't go for what they want to do like all the other children can.
Betsy, same kind of thing here. It's not even necessarily just music. I mean, I know you're a music therapist, but we have to send that signal. I just think that
we get acclimated to what we know and what we can comprehend. I feel like we see this actually, I'm taking a little further. We see this today in people who are anxious about groups of people, people who are different from us. And what you see in society is that the more access you have to people who are different from you, the more that there's someone who's gay in your family, or the more that there's you live in a community with people of different backgrounds, the more you support them and their access to society and their access to the civil rights. So I do think the more people see somebody like Galen, and the more people see someone like Perlman, and the more people see the disability and the success, that they'll be more creative and they'll be more open to what's possible.
Here's Kathy writing the program and says, Evan, thank you for this important conversation. And it's not just teachers who can hold young students back. Sometimes it's well-meaning parents who are afraid for their kids. Oh. Erica, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that there's such a nervousness that your child is disabled, so that makes them somehow more fragile. So it's harder to let them try new things that the parents have no idea what the event is going to be like. But we live in a really great time right now, because there's so many different inventive ways of doing things, like having interpreters at concerts. That is so cool. That is so inclusive. And people like Amber Galloway in Texas, going to rock concerts, going to hip-hop and rap concerts, and creating that access opens up the world more to people who have not traditionally been a part.
Technologically, there's so many changes. I first started working in rehabilitation medicine in 1986, and everything was mechanical. And now we can do so much with computers and laser technology. There's no excuse not to have people involved.
Saturday, 1:30, Galen Lee at the Schultz Center at Nazareth College. And it's just $5 to attend. Betsy and Erica, you're fans of Galen. You're going to be there?
I will be there.
I'm hosting her.
You're hosting her. So what do you want the community to know about this kind of an opportunity, Betsy?
Well, I think that she's also going to speak. She's going to play and speak and do a Q&A as well. So there's really going to be an opportunity to interact. And I hope that the audience likes to talk to each other and create creative ideas right there in the space.
Hmm. Erica, what are you looking forward to most?
Oh, goodness. Just honestly seeing her. I think she's awesome, and I love her music, and I have a deep appreciation for the violin, even though it didn't work out for me.
So if you picked up a violin now, could you still play?
Oh, I don't know if you'd want to hear that music.
And so with Galen coming here, she mentioned in that conversation the number of stages that really are accessible, and it was not a big number. That was even less than I would have thought, just because maybe I naively think that, it's 2017. We have to equip spaces, whether it's a stage or a building, an entrance, et cetera. I was surprised at how little accessibility she has found and how she's working to change that. But, there's Betsy shaking her head saying you should not be surprised.
Well, we were talking about this during her conversation, and I was coming at it from an accessibility to the audience perspective, and Erica pointed out that the stages themselves are not accessible.
Yeah, so tell me about just this space, what you look for, and were you surprised to hear that stages themselves were as inaccessible as Galen has found?
Well, just my own personal experience, Well, once you're on the stage, it's accessible, but getting you to the stage, there's not often a way. It's usually stairs. So if you have a physical disability, if you're a chair user, there's often not a way for you to even do that.
I guess that, you know, that's why occasionally we see it kind of stages that haven't been updated. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people are carrying wheelchairs.
Mm-hmm. Lifting them up. And as Galen said so clearly, what does that say to somebody who's watching her who desires to be a musician? Even if I achieve something, this is still going to be happening to me. That's really sad.
Mm. How do you feel about that, Erica?
Not only is that humiliating, but it's also dangerous because people are picking you up that don't necessarily have the experience and you could be dropped. So there's different layers to this. Just as a rule, don't lift people up in their chairs, guys.
I wanted to put in a plug. Our new performance center at Nazareth, one of the most exciting things for me, we're building it right now, is that you'll be able to go from the parking lot to the lobby, down the ramp to the chair, to the seats themselves, never seeing a set of stairs.
Very cool. Very cool. Erica, when we talk about physical spaces and what accessibility means, in Galen Lee's case, if you're just joining us, she was my guest in the first half hour, the winner of NPR's 2016 Tiny Desk Contest. And she's talking about stages. Where else in your daily life do you see a lack of accessibility with regularity? Where can we do much better?
Oh, my goodness. Things from parking spaces. If you expected people to come to your event and all you have to offer is street parking, that can be a problem. For instance, in my car, I side transfer. I put my chair from next to the driver's side into my car across me. And I can't do that in street parking because that's extremely dangerous.
Hmm. Again, something that not routinely crossing my mind. Okay, there's an example. Where mm-hmm. else do you see, where else are you sort of routinely either frustrated or observing, hey, this could be much more accessible?
If you go to venues, there are several throughout Rochester that there's the assumption that disabled people don't travel together, don't go to shows together, don't go to sporting events together. So the seating is often segregated. And
one wheelchair seat at a time.
Right. So at Frontier Fields, if you have two wheelchair users, you can't sit next to each other. You have to sit where there's a big seat right in the middle of the two of you. So if I go with my boyfriend, I can't sit next to him like everyone else can.
I'd also like to mention freight elevators. We were talking about this earlier. Mm-hmm. Venues assume that if they have an elevator for you, that's acceptable. But my elderly parents go to concerts at the University of Indiana all the time. And at one of the venues, they have to take a freight elevator. And that's not only it may be physically accessible, but it's not emotionally accessible. Mm.
In our last couple of minutes, let me just ask our guests about the music itself that you heard from Galen and that beautiful, well, the song that she has that won NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. But also, you know, she's been playing and performing for a number of years now, and she is legit. She's so good. It's one of the reasons I wanted to start the interview very intentionally. I've seen a lot of interviews with her. In preparing for these kinds of programs, I like to watch other conversations people have had. And understandably so, a lot of people have questions about brittle bone disease, how it impacted her as a child, what it means to her performance now. All interesting and all important. That's part of the work that she's doing. But I also don't want to just pigeonhole her. So I just wanted to talk about music first. Do you have a concern sometimes, Erica, that people who are succeeding still sometimes get pigeonholed as, oh, that's the disability athlete, that's the disability musician, as opposed mm-hmm. to Galen won that contest because of the song.
Right.
She happens to have brittle bone disease.
Right. And honestly, I'm in this unique position where I'm a proud disabled woman, but I'm also a lot of things. I don't want to be known as this specific thing and that's it. And I'm sure it's the same thing for her. She is an excellent musician and she's an excellent musician, period. She's also she's also a disabled person. So you can be proud of many different identities. You don't have to just stick with one for the rest of your life.
Yeah. What did you think of the music itself, Betsy?
Well, I love the music, and I love the way she layers and the way she uses modes.
Yeah.
And so her sound is unique, not because of her disability, but because of the musical choices she's making. You know, when you use looping technology, you have to make certain choices about your harmonic progressions. And so she's doing some really clever things in the way that she chooses her first layer that enable her to create a song that doesn't sound static, even though the lower layer has stayed the same for the whole song. That takes a lot of thought and creativity.
It's not... I was thinking exactly that, only I wasn't because I don't have your musical mind, Betsy, but it was something exactly like that. No, that's exactly why I asked, because I know someone like Betsy, who's a professor of music therapy at Nazareth College, can grab onto that and say, what is this looping technology? How is she using it? How beautiful, you know, how innovative is that? Check her out if you haven't looked it up, if you only heard the interview. Galen, G-A-E-L-Y-N-N, Lee, L-E-A. Check her out, NPR Tiny Desk Contest winner from 2016. She's going to be at Nazareth College's Schultz Center at 1:30 Saturday afternoon, $5 only. It's going to be a wonderful performance from a wonderful musician. It's been great talking to her. And Betsy King from Nazareth, thanks for coming in. Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Erica Jones, you may not be playing violin anymore, but you're doing a lot of great things too. There's thank you. Thank you for being here. Great having you. Thanks for listening. Rob Braden, Audrey Sample, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson with you. We're right back with you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.